Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman,
where smart people get their news.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Monday to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, a lot in the news. The president of Sudan, of northern Sudan, arguably, well, he's the president of all of Sudan, actually, Bashir, is Hafez al-Bashir, is going to be indicted, apparently, by the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague for war crimes, crimes against humanity. This is the same court that we all hope someday will be taking up the issue of George W. Bush in Iraq. You see, 300,000 people are dead in Darfur. This is the best UN estimate. And about 2 million have fled their villages in Darfur. When we did our show from southern Sudan, about 30 miles from the Darfur border, back in March by satellite phone, along with Ellen Ratner and Rusty Humphreys and Jack Rice and my son Justin was with us, and I'm trying to remember who else. I think, oh, and Dan Patterson with the Talk Radio News Service. We were in a village of 8,000 people that had bloated up to 45,000 people, many of them refugees from Darfur, all of whom said that most of the members of their family had been murdered, their families had been murdered. So here we have this major genocide. And the BBC today, they have this program called Panorama. It's sort of like 60 Minutes. And Panorama, the Panorama TV program, has tracked down and proven that the Chinese are actually helping. Well, here, the BBC has found the first evidence that China is currently helping Sudan's military government militarily in Darfur. The Panorama TV program tracked down Chinese army lorries, trucks, in the Sudanese province that came from a batch exported from China to Sudan in 2005. The BBC was also told that China was training fighter pilots who fly Chinese A-5 Fantan fighter jets in Darfur. And what they do there is they come in and they bomb these villages, blow up all the buildings, set the villages on fire, and then the Janjaweed come in on horseback and camelback and literally rape and pillage. Murder the men, rape the women, set everything that's not already on fire, and then the few straggling survivors end up in the town that we were at, Gok Machar, and other ones similar to it, on the South Sudan side of the border. So Bashir is going to be indicted for war crimes. Two members of his cabinet have already been indicted for war crimes, but now we're talking about the president of an African nation. We'll see where that goes. The other big thing in the news, and this has been going on for some time, and in my opinion, this is the big issue. I mean, Gerald Celente over at the Trends Research Institute has issued a code red. He says the panic of code red, protect your future now. 2 weeks ago on this program, we have Ravi Batra, the professor of economics at Southern Methodist University and New York Times bestselling author of a half a dozen books, including most recently The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud, in which he suggests, and in fact, he came right out and he said, we are facing a crisis. And he said, as an economist, these are not words that he uses lightly. In fact, I think he used the word disaster is on the horizon. And he talked about one of Ravi Batra's pieces of advice, and this sounds alarmist, was if you have more than $100,000 in a bank or more than $250,000 in an IRA in a bank that are insured by the FSLIC or the FDIC, distribute that money among other banks. Well, Friday it happened. Here we had this bank, IndyMac, which was seized. And what's really fascinating is I was just, you know, kicking around the internet looking at different articles and different newspapers, and I was unable to find very many that mentioned the fact that about 10,000 people who had deposits at IndyMac in excess of $100,000 are going to basically get nothing beyond that, or very little, after they sell off the assets of the bank. So, I mean, literally, you've got Americans who are on the outside looking in now. Here's one story in the AP. Some 10,000 depositors had funds in excess of the insured limit. But here in the Sunday paper in Oregon, the Portland, Oregonian article by Gretchen Morganson called her column Fair Game, the headline, The Fannie and Freddie Fallout. This is the more conventional wisdom. She writes, it's dispiriting indeed to watch the United States financial system, supposedly the envy of the world, be taken to its knees, but that's the show we're watching. Brought to you by somnambulant regulators, greedy bank executives, and incompetent corporate directors. Well, I'm sorry, it's not brought to you by any of the above. It's brought to you by Phil Graham. This goes back to the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999. It was first proposed in 1998. It was also called the Financial Services Modernization Act, or the Graham-Leach Financial Services Modernization Act. And what it did was essentially roll back a law that was put into place in 1935. Now, it called the Glass-Steagall Act. In 1935, Roosevelt was looking at, I mean, they had to shut down banks. Banks were going out of business all over the country, and he just said, okay, that's it. We're going to have a banking holiday. And for a couple of days, they just closed all of them, said, we're going to sort all this out and put it back together. And a lot of people lost a lot of money because banks had been loaning out money based on equity, based on collateral, which was stock. In other words, you go to the bank and you say, hey, I want to borrow $10,000 to buy some stock. And they say, well, do you have $10,000 worth of assets? And the person would say, sure, I got $10,000 worth of RCA stock at $400 a share. RCA went in the market at like $7. And it was up, it was almost to $600, or in the neighborhood of $600 in October of 1929. These were the new radio stocks. They were the internet stocks and the banking stocks of the day. This was the bubble. And they were just going through the roof. Or roof, depending on what part of the country you're from. And so they would say to the bank, yeah, I've got, RCA. I've got $10,000 with RCA stock at $400 a share, and I want to borrow another $10,000 against that. And the bank would say, okay, you got $10,000 in equity. We'll loan you $10,000 or, you know, even less. I mean, you know, it's, and then the people would take that $10,000 that they borrowed from the bank, and they'd buy $100,000 worth of stock from a brokerage house on margin, 10 to 1. And then they go back to the bank and say, well, I've got access to $100,000 worth of stock. Loan me $100,000. And this kind of thing, you know, this cycling. And in many cases, the banks and the brokerage houses were the same agencies, the same institutions. So this could all be done with one person and one institution. And so what happened was when the value of the stock started dropping in October of 1929, when people looked around and they said, why is RCA worth $600 a share? When you look at the real assets of the company, and it should probably be worth $50 a share. And the failure of RCA and a couple of other large radio stocks, RCA being the biggest, led the collapse, this bubble bursting in the radio industry of all things, which was essentially the high-tech industry of the day. This bubble bursting in the 1930s led the collapse, the overall collapse of the stock market. So here we are again. Well, actually, let me go back to that. So in 1935, Franklin Roosevelt, is part of the New Deal, he said, you know, we can't let this happen. Banks are part of our commons. So much so that in the founding of this country, we had several presidents, or several people, actually. Alexander Hamilton was never president, but he certainly wanted to be. But he was first the first Secretary of the Treasury. And you had Alexander Hamilton, who argued that we should have a national bank. And in fact, we did on two different occasions. We had a national bank, the first and second national bank of the United States. And the second one went out of business in the 1840s, late 1840, I think it was 1846, and some argue that that led right to the Civil War because, another boom and bust cycle began. But in any case, the whole point was that the banks were considered part of the commons. It was all this stuff that, without the banks, without a solid and stable banking system, how can you possibly have an economy that works? How can you have a country that works? You can't. So they're part of the commons. So it made sense that they would be highly regulated by the government. And so the government said so that the commons doesn't get hijacked by profiteers. And so basically the deal that they made was, you guys who own the banks, we're going to make sure that you make a nice, steady, boring profit. It's like Monopoly, it's a utility kind of thing. Or like the railroads, the regulated railroads. Nice, steady, you're never going to lose money. And from 1935 with the Glass-Steagall Act until 1999, banks didn't lose money. They made a nice, steady, boring profit. And then came Phil Graham.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Your radio support group for We the People.
A bunch of things that brought this about. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Most of them have to do with this ideology that really is relatively new. They like to quote Adam Smith, but Adam Smith actually talked about national interest. Adam Smith actually talked about beware of the invisible hand of the marketplace and talked about the commons and the obligation to regulate the commons and the obligation of businesses to operate first and foremost in the national interest, in the interest of the people. But there's a series of events here. You can look at there were a couple of Supreme Court decisions, Buckley versus Vallejo, First National Bank versus Bilotti. These were Supreme Court decisions that essentially said that money is speech and corporations are persons, and so they can use their money and their speech to influence elections. These were in the 70s and the 80s. In 1978, there was a famous Supreme Court decision, the Marquette case. And basically what the 78 Marquette case said, in fact, you can read about this on the FDIC's website, FDIC.gov. There's a whole analysis of this. And what they said was different states had different what were called usury laws. It was, you couldn't in one state charge more than 10% interest. In another state, you couldn't charge more than 12% interest. In another state, you couldn't charge more than 15% interest if you were a credit card company. So the credit card companies had to deal with all these different states and all these different rules. And it was very, it was very difficult for them. So in their opinions, so they went to the Supreme Court and they said, we want this changed. And the Supreme Court wiped out all these rules. It said you can have a national standard. And if you look at this graph, the FDIC Division of Insurance Bank Trends Analysis of Emerging Risks in Banking. This is a March 1998 news release, number 98-05. And as I said, this is on the government's website, FDIC.gov. And you look at bankruptcy, and they graph out bankruptcy filings and total credit card and related, debt, the amount of money that people have on credit. And from it starts in 66, and it's like this flat line. It's like less than $1 billion. In fact, it's less than $500 million, all the way up until 78. And then in 78, you had the Marquette decision, and then boom, by 1982, second year of the Reagan administration, it's up to $1 billion. By 1987, it's up to $2 billion. By 1990, it's up to $3 billion. By 1994, it's up to it's pushing $4 billion. Excuse me, hundreds of billions of dollars. We're looking at millions, and at the same time, the millions of bankruptcy filings went from under 1 million bankruptcy filings in 78 at the time of the Marquette decision, to almost 4 million bankruptcy filings in 96, the last year that the graph is there. So basically what they're saying is that this Marquette decision deregulated the credit card industry. Now, fast forward to 1999. In February of 1999, in the spring of 1999, Time magazine had on its cover, and for those of you watching the Tom Vision webcam, I'm holding this up. They had Robert Rubin, Alan Greenspan, and Lawrence Summers on the cover of Time magazine. And the headline is "The Committee to Save the World." They refer to these guys as the Three Marketeers. And it was Rubin and Greenspan who sat Clinton down 2 weeks before he was inaugurated, after he ran on a platform in 92, after he ran on a platform saying that he was going to defend the interests of labor in this country. Sat him down and said, you can't do that. It's got to be of, by, and for the bankers. And it's very, very interesting. You read this article, and this is back in 99, right? Now, we've had 7 years of the Clinton administration, and things are looking good because there's a bubble going on that Greenspan fueled. And, you know, here's from the article. Greenspan has a theory that holds them all together. This is these three guys, Summers, Greenspan, and Robert Rubin, who all feature very prominently, by the way, in an NPR documentary about the wonders of neoliberalism, basically. They have a theory that holds them together, a belief in so-called supply-side economics. No matter what the data showed, the results among Reagan-era economists like Arthur Laffler were always the same. Tax cuts and less regulation were the solution. Their faith is in the markets and in their own ability to analyze them. It's unusual, Greenspan says. In Washington, usually you come to the table and everyone meets and no one changes their mind. But with us, you have something else. This pragmatism, and this is from the Time magazine's cover story, this pragmatism is a faith that recalls nothing so much as the objectivist philosophy of the novelist and social critic Ayn Rand, author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, which Greenspan has studied intently. During long nights at Ayn Rand's apartment and through her articles and letters, Greenspan found in objectivism a sense that markets are an expression of the deepest truths about human nature and that as a result they will ultimately be correct. They all agree, this is Greenspan, Summers, and Rubin, they all agree that trying to defy market forces is in the end futile. In other words, just give it up. Democracy is irrelevant. Just deregulate the whole thing. Kick open the doors. Just let the big corporations do whatever they want. If you have CEOs who are making hundreds of millions of dollars, it must be because the market dictated it. Because after all, the market's better than democracy. The market is the ultimate thing. Well, what we're discovering now, 15, 20 years in, 30 years into this thing, it really started with Reagan, and it reached its peak in the last years of the Clinton administration in 98, 99, when Phil Graham and his buddies rolled back the Glass-Steagall Act that kept banks out of the investment business, is a disaster.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
So back in 1935, basically what the Roosevelt administration said and what Congress said, and it was a very reasonable and rational thing to say, by the way, basically what they said was, if you want to have an institution that makes money on speculation, that buys and sells securities, that owns securities, that takes deposits against securities and issues money market, the equivalent of money market funds, things like that, that's fine, but you can't call it an investment bank. You can't call it a normal depository bank. You can call it something else, but you can't call it a bank. And that was the law of the land from 1935 until 1999, when a $200 million lobbying effort, one that made the lobbying effort to get FISA through this corruption of the FISA bill through a couple of weeks ago, look like a piker, a $200 million lobbying effort led by Phil Gramm, who was at the time United States Senator from Texas, or not led by, but, you know, he was the lead guy in the Senate, introduced the Gramm-Leach legislation that did away with the Glass-Steagall Act and said, sure, banks can get into the investment business. So now banks were loaning money to people on their houses, and then they were selling those loans to themselves and packaging them and then packaging those as investments and then selling those investments out into the marketplace. But they were ultimately responsible for them. And in many cases, actually, they were buying those investments and selling them to people and saying, here, put this in your 401k. This bundle of this investment called XYZ Investment, which is actually a whole bunch of mortgages. And it was a house built on cards. And it was exactly the same thing as what happened in 1929. Only in 1929, the banks were doing it with stock. And in 1998 and 99 and 2000 and 2001 and 2000, well, through the last decade, banks have been doing it on real estate. But other than that, it's the exact same thing. It used to be illegal. And in the name of this insane neoliberal free market ideology, this Thatcherism, this Reaganism, this idea that markets will solve everything because they're based on numbers and they're magical. They're like they're something from heaven because they're not manipulated by people, because we can't trust people who actually have the public interest at heart. We can only trust the marketplace. So unregulate the marketplace. And what happens when you unregulate the marketplace? The predatory people come into it. So here now, over at, and a tip of the hat to the folks in our chat room for this, the Straits Times. This is, you know, one of the big newspapers out of Hong Kong. This is actually their New York Dateline. United States banks may fail in far greater numbers following the collapse of the big mortgage lender IndyMac Bank Corp, straining a financial system seeking stability after years of lending excesses. More than 300 banks could fail in the next 3 years, said RBC Capital Markets analyst Gerard Cassidy, who in February had estimated no more than 150. And then they go through, you know, how and why and all this kind of stuff. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. During the break, you know, I ran down to the restroom, and we're here in a station that has five radio stations, a Clear Channel cluster, and one of the other stations in this building runs Rush Limbaugh, and I'm in the bathroom where Rush Limbaugh is on the radio, and I'm hearing him as he's wrapping up his half hour. He goes, and Chuck Schumer, he's the one responsible for this. Right! You know, the guy who called the fire department, he's responsible for the fire. I don't believe it. You know, the cons and the neocons are going to say, oh, yeah, this is all because somebody dared to talk about it. Give me a break. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Henry in Texarkana, Arkansas. Hey, Henry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Hey, look here. There was another show that you always listen to all the time. You know the guy, but he was talking about earlier in George Bush administration, the main thing that neocons wanted to do was pretty much to bankrupt America and reconstruct what they wanted to be. And if you look at it, between the oil industry, the banking industry, and Wall Street and things, they pretty much have done it.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Screwed, you know, that came out 2 years ago, that basically undeclared war against the middle class, which basically lays out that premise. And this is something that goes back to the 60s, by the way. That
right.
when the conservatives were looking at, and excellent call, Henry, thank you. When conservatives were looking at the, quote, social unrest of the 60s, you know, kids out in the streets, kids on the college campuses, African-Americans, gays, women asking for equal rights, other minority groups, et cetera, they looked at this, they said, this is an unstable country. Why is it unstable? Because there's a strong middle class. They've got a lot of economic power. They're not afraid of losing their job. They're not afraid of taking a couple of days off. They've got enough money to get out there and protest. The kids aren't worried about losing, you know, being kicked out of school or whatnot, because school is cheap and it's subsidized by the government. And in many cases, it was free. The University of California system was free before Ronald Reagan got a hold of it. And so the conservatives said, we can't have this. We've got to destroy this middle class. Now, it wasn't done because they're evil people. It was done because they believe that the best thing for our country is stability. That's the nature of the conservative worldview. William F. Buckley said, conservatives are people who stand astride the course of history screaming stop. They didn't want the instability that came with the rabble, with the strong middle class. Tim in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Very interesting show. You know, what today is called modern neoliberalism has a lot of roots, actually. And one of them actually is the Rand Corporation. Now, the
yes.
Rand Corporation is pretty much known as the defense, and they were the first ones to come up with this idea of a quote-unquote winnable thermonuclear war.
That's right. This was in the 1950s during the Cold War. And who was the guy that they made the movie about, A Beautiful Mind?
That famous economist who had certain mental issues.
Yeah, he was a paranoid schizophrenic, and he came up with the theory that all human behavior could be reduced to ciphers, to numeric values, and that every person really only had one goal, and that was to achieve maximum advantage. And that became the basis of game theory, which became the basis of the way that we played the Cold War. Which, led to our having 12,000 missiles and the Soviet Union having 9,000. But also, that then became the rationale for Rubin, Greenspan, and Summers and all these guys with their shock theory, their shock therapy in the Soviet Union that was a disaster, their shock therapy in Chile and Argentina, which was a disaster, their privatization of the Chilean social security system, which was a disaster, their shock therapy in Iraq, which was a disaster. All of this stuff, because they thought that if you just got government out of the way and just let everybody behave in their own enlightened self-interest, then everything would be wonderful, and democracy would flourish. And it turns out that they're wrong.
Yeah, this is the whole idea of the utility function, which presupposes that all human beings just serve themselves, which
That's
is you
right.
know, it's contradicted by society, which is even contradicted by religion, because we do have a collectivist nature within us.
We do. We're a herd animal, as it were. We're a clan animal. We're a tribe animal. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. John Nash was the guy who was in A Beautiful
That's right.
Mind. Thank you, Sean Taylor, my producer, just shared that with me. And not only that, you know, what's particularly interesting was Nash posited, you know, they came up with game theory, and they came up with these things like the prisoner's dilemma, you know, where say you've robbed a bank and you've got a gem worth $100 million, and you got to sell it to a criminal, and only a criminal would buy it. And how do you get it to him and get the money from him without him stealing it from you? So you make a deal where you say, I'll go to a field in one place, and you go to a field in another place, and you bury the money, and I'll bury the diamond, and then we'll call each other and tell each other where each other's field is, and we can go collect it. And Nash concluded that the only way to win the game would be to screw the other guy, to not bury the money in the field, because that way you at least, or not bury the diamond in the field, because that way the worst that would happen is either you got to keep the diamond, or you got the diamond and the money. And so logic would indicate that that's how the other person would always play the game. And when they tried to play this game, this prisoner's dilemma game, which became the basis of our Cold War strategies and has become now the basis of our economy under these guys, when they played this game with secretaries at the Rand Corporation, they always, instead of screwing the other guy, took the choice of trusting the other guy. Always, 100% of the time. And over time, they've repeated this. I mean, this has been 50 years now. Over time, they've repeated this experiment over and over and over, and they've discovered that there are only two groups of people who will consistently behave consistent with game theory, who will consistently screw the other guy in their own self-interest. Only two groups of people, economists, professional economists, and psychopaths.
Psychopaths, right. Yeah, the utility function actually seems to be contradicted by real life.
Yeah, yeah, and, spot on, Tim, and thank you very much for the call and for pointing it out. I mean, it's absolutely. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James, we've got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Okay, Tom, quickly, in terms of Phil Gray when he was putting this act together, at the same time, I'm not sure, wasn't he lobbying for a Swiss bank, I think HSBC? Because I'm reading part of the regulation online. One of the things it calls for is provides financial treatment for foreign banks wanting to engage in the new financial activities authorized under the act.
Oh, I doubt he would have been lobbying at the time he was a U.S. senator, because that's against the law, although his wife may have been. She, you know, Wendy Graham was an economist. She was one of the directors of Enron Corporation. She's actually much smarter than her husband. You know, her PhD thesis actually makes sense. His is rather pathetic. But I don't know. I frankly don't know. But I would consider it unlikely, although he could well have been working in their interests. And that's you know, essentially the same thing. I mean, wherever you go. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com or Air America, go to the Tom Hartman page. And also, we're broadcast, we're videocasting live. You can find that at the top at TomHartman.com and over at AirAmerica.com as well. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
See, here's the amazing thing. There's been this essentially war of ideas going on for the last half a century. Starting in the 1940s, 1950s, in large part, you had Friedrich von Hayek, you had Milton Friedman from the Chicago School of Economics. You had these guys who were suggesting that because there's a million variables in any economic decision, that there's no way that government can regulate an economy. And at the level of the Soviet Union, for example, they were right. I mean, it's nuts to have the government own the steel industry and the car industry and the television industry and the shoe industry and own every retail store and set every price and set all the wages. That's crazy. They were absolutely right in that regard. But they took it to the next step. The crazy step, and they said government should play no role whatsoever in regulating capitalism. They should simply throw the doors open. Well, that's what we used to have for like 6,000 years. It was called basically robber baron or laissez-faire, absolutely no rules, let it be capitalism. And what it led to was a series of booms and busts. About every 30 years in the United States, all the way back to the founding of this country, we had a Great Depression. And you can go back into British history and you can see it for a couple of hundred years, for a thousand years. You can see it in the Roman times. Basically, these elites would rise up, they'd concentrate all the wealth, they'd crash the economy, they'd pick up the pieces, the average person, the poor people get screwed, there was no middle class. And so Franklin Roosevelt said no. And John Maynard Keynes, you know, let's have a middle class, let's have some regulation here, let's make this thing work. And it worked beautifully from the 1930s when they put this stuff into place until Ronald Reagan started deconstructing it in the 1980s. Arguably, Jimmy Carter actually started deconstructing it with his zeal for deregulation. Deregulating the airline industry and the trucking industry was the beginning. And now truckers are screwed and airlines are in trouble. Frank in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. Hey, Frank.
Well, the whole thing is privatizing the infrastructure and deregulation is destroying the country, and these people are not dumb. They know that the same thing happened in the past, and the result was what's happening today.
Right, rich get richer and everybody else gets screwed.
Not, you know, like you say, we're getting screwed. And the point is that if this happened in China, we should have their policy. They'd cut their heads off when they make an error.
Well, I don't think I'd go that far, Frank.
Well,
but here's the problem anyway,
they got to pay a price for something because they didn't come out of the blue sky and say, well, this is good for the economy, when in the past all this deregulation has destroyed the economy and
caused
poor class.
Frank, spot on. You're absolutely right. And you still have NPR holding these guys out. You still have NPR and Corporation for Public Broadcasting only running programs on business every day and never running programs on labor. You still have newspapers that no longer have labor sections. They only have business sections. You still have entire TV networks devoted to business and not to labor. The ideology that it's all about the wealthy and the corporate elite. And if they rule things, forget about government. Government's, you know, old hat. Government's a bad thing. Democracy is an imperfect tool. The market is the perfect tool. That has actually won the day. That thinking has won the day. The vast majority of Americans actually believe that right now. And this is where it started.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And they set out to destroy the ability of government to simply constrain capitalism so that it could function in a way that both allowed people to make money and start businesses and become wealthy and allowed for a strong middle class and a strong economy in the country. And in the process of destroying the middle class and destroying, you know, the regulatory systems in the name of so-called free markets, they've destroyed the middle class and dramatically increased poverty, social mobility right now, the ability of the poor to the children of the poor to grow up to be middle class or wealthy, the ability of the middle class to for their children to grow up to be wealthy, the ability of the wealthy, for that matter, for their children to end up poor. Social mobility in the United States is below where it was in 1900. We have become an absolutely rigidified society. Only the riches, only the children of the rich become rich. Only the, and the children of the poor, the only option they have now is to become poor, by and large. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, the fallacy of the argument of letting the free market solve all the problems is companies are motivated by profit. And sometimes things have to get to a crisis stage before it's profitable. If you look at, for example, renewable energies, you know, T. Boone Pickens getting into the wind industry. It's great. Yeah. Unfortunately, he's only doing it now because it's profitable. Government, who should be motivated by what's good for the people, should have been on this 8, 10, 20 years ago.
And Jimmy Carter was.
We wouldn't be in the
Jimmy Carter was. 30 years ago, Jimmy Carter was on this. And you will find all over the United States houses that were built in the late 1970s. You know, let's see, what Reagan came in the election of 80. Yeah, in the late 70s. As a result of the tax credits that, that Jimmy Carter put into place, and the first, and Reagan came into office and he took the solar collectors off the roof of the White House and he said, screw this stuff, you know, all this alternative energy. Jimmy Carter had it set up that 20% of our electricity by the year 2000 would be supplied by solar power. I mean, you're absolutely right, Rich, and it's, this is the destruction of America at the hands of these conservatives. It's the absolute destruction of America. Larry in Phoenix.
Yeah, I called for two things. One was to disagree with you on one thing, and the other was to suggest your next book possibly, and that would be the comparison of the Medici, the rise of the Medici family in Italy.
Right.
Back when they were allowed to take over the finances for the Pope, for the
yep.
church.
Yep.
And then they ended up taking over the church and
yep.
almost destroying the middle class, everybody in Italy, and they had to rise up.
Well, there virtually was no middle class at that time. There was basically
yeah, well,
the working poor.
What, you know, survival back then might have been considered middle class now.
Yeah. Real quick,
compare
Larry.
Compare that to the rise of the Bush family when they after they got control of the CIA and all the.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, if you go back and you look at Kevin Phillips' last book, it was about the Bush dynasty, and not his most recent one, the one before that. And how dynasties, how dynastic families are ultimately destructive to democracy. Coming up next, Kerry Lucas.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
On Common Sense from the Radical Middle.
This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Kerry Lucas is with us. She's the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. Hey, Kerry, welcome to the show. It's always a pleasure having you on. You're kind of the conservative energizer bunny. I mean, it's just I love your enthusiasm.
Oh well, thank you.
You have a blog post or an article. I'm not sure what you would call it. Called Domestic Disturbance over at the Independent Women's Forum. For Families, Barack Obama is an Unwelcome Throwback is the subtitle. And you say, at a speech in New Mexico this week, for instance, Senator Obama lamented how unfair the workplace is for women earning less than men to minimum wage workers struggling to meet rising food and energy costs. He championed a litany of proposals, including a massive expansion, I'm paraphrasing here, a massive expansion of the Family and Medical Leave Act, the FMLA, And currently, you say only businesses with more than 50 employees are affected by FMLA. Obama wants to drag all businesses into the FMLA net. The FMLA, by the way, the Family and Medical Leave Act, says that right now, if your spouse dies or if is in the hospital with cancer or your kid gets cancer or somebody has a heart attack or whatever, that your employer is required to give you up to 7 days off with no pay before they can fire you for not showing up. And that's without pay. And Obama says that's not fair. It should be at least 7 paid sick days a year by law. And you're opposed to this, if I read this
and,
right.
You know, it's really, I think that setup is a perfect example of some of the difficulties of being conservative, because, of course, everybody's listening says, gosh, this is terrible. This woman must be crazy and heartless to be against something that would mandate these poor people. As you said, somebody whose a spouse has cancer or has a sick child, has an illness of their own. And, of course, I sympathize, and I think that I hope that everybody out there has benefits and are able to take paid leave time. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to have the government come in and essentially outlaw a whole set of employment arrangements, which, because that raises the cost of employment and reduces opportunities, it means more people will be out of work. It sounds really good when you talk about mandating more benefits or forcing employers to provide things to their employees, but if those benefits have costs, that means that people are going to have lower take-home pay, or there are going to be fewer job opportunities. So we've got to look a little deeper than just the payoff that's so obvious.
Well, we were in Denmark a couple of weeks ago. We did our show there for a week, and we had members of their parliament on, and economists, and you know, average citizens, a whole bunch of people. And in Denmark, if a woman gets pregnant and she's working, she can take up to a year off with pay, and her husband can take a half a year off with pay. And this is a fairly common thing. And I had an American on who has lived in Denmark for, I think, 18, 20 years, something like that, owns a business which employs 20-some-odd people, 22 people, I think, which does translation services from English to Danish. And he said he employs a lot of women doing this, younger women who tend to get pregnant. And I said, isn't this, you know, crippling your business? And he said, no, you just, you know, you plan. First of all, the government backstops you on, you know, we're just talking about a week here with the FMLA. That's no big deal. I mean, we're talking about a year in Denmark. He says the government reimburses you for much of it. He says, but you just plan for it by, you know, you overhire a little bit. And I said, well, is that destroying your profitability? He says, well, yeah, we're probably a little less profitable than we might be, but our business is running just fine. Thank you very much. This brings up the question, Carrie, and I think that this is really the essential question. First of all, I would submit to you that if the FMLA were expanded, it would actually increase employment, as it did in Denmark, for that very reason. But really the question is the economy here, and the people who basically own the economy, because in a capitalist economy there are the owners, the stockholders, and the shareholders, which is increasingly many of us, but in particular the managers or the owners of the company, is the economy here to serve society? In other words, do we offer the benefits of incorporation to individuals who want to incorporate, all the tax breaks and all the other benefits that are associated with that, and I'm a beneficiary of that as well. Do we offer that to people, to businesses, to encourage business for the benefit of business, or do we offer that because we believe that there will ultimately be some societal benefit? In other words, is the economy here to serve we the people, or are we the people here to serve the economy?
You see, I think that's a very misleading question. You know, I think it's the essence of the issue. Well, I think it's here to serve the people, but I think that my version of serving the people is very different than what you seem to be suggesting. You know, when I think about this, and I imagine that out there have to be some people who run businesses. My father-in-law runs a small pharmacy, a store out there near Little Rock, Arkansas, in Jacksonville, Arkansas. And he employs, I don't know exactly how many people, but I bet it's around a dozen. And this is a job. It's a store, and people have to show up, and if they don't show up, that means other workers have to be the ones to fill their
have
job.
To get overtime.
Yeah, well, no, but yeah, they have to get overtime. They have to just do more of the work if somebody doesn't show up. And for my father-in-law, it's tough making ends meet, and that means sometimes he has to let people go, and sometimes he has to.
I would submit to you, Carrie, that it's, you know, having run a lot of businesses myself over the years, some with fewer than 25 employees and some with more, And that's, by the way, the new threshold for FMLA, not zero, but 25. Obama's proposing dropping it from 50 to 25. But nonetheless, I would submit to you that your father's challenge is probably more that if he's running an independent pharmacy, is probably more that unregulated laissez-faire capitalism that you advocate has led to the rise of these giant mega chains that are eating his lunch.
Well, that's probably a topic for another day. There's certainly, you know, and actually you're right, that there's a lot of other things that government does that's really hard on independent pharmacists and on businesses in general. The Medicare prescription.
Well, I'd say it's predatory big corporations are doing it.
Pharmacies. Pardon?
I'd say it's the predatory big corporations that are doing it.
You've got
capitalism.
He wouldn't say that. It's one of those things that, you know, he can compete with some of the big chains and offer them different things. But part of, you know, one of the real problems that faces independent pharmacies is the Medicare prescription drug bill, which has just squeezed profitability out of providing drugs. Right.
That's a whole completely different issue. But back to this issue. How is it that your dad's pharmacy is going to be harmed if he has to pay 7 sick days a year to somebody?
You know,
if they have a disaster in their family.
This is my father-in-law's business, and I have no idea if the extent to which he has provides these benefits. But I think that it's important for people out there. If you're a small businessman, you know that, okay, so maybe it's harder to see when you talk about 7 paid business paid days off. But we know that raises the cost of employment.
Sure.
And that means that has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, it comes out of profits.
Profits are not this thing that just some evil genie gobbles up and...
No, profits are the money I put in my pocket at the end of the year when I take out dividends from my corporation.
Don't make that much profits. Profits end up just paying the salary of the guy who's doing the hard work of running that business.
No, that's a deductible expense. That's pre-profit.
Well, I mean, it's an economic fact that by raising the cost of employment, you're going to either hire fewer workers, pay those workers less. It has to come from
No,
somewhere.
Not necessarily at all. Not necessarily at all. In fact, it may well be that you actually increase the number of workers. If you're increasing the number of workers who are going to be available to you through the year, if you decrease, rather, the number of workers by giving some of them paid leave, or, for example, in France, 6 weeks of paid vacation are required. Every corporation has to do that. So every corporation hires, you know, what would that be, like maybe 1/10 or 1/15 of a person. In other words, for every 10 people, they actually add one more person to the workforce so that there's always somebody there when somebody's on vacation.
You know,
it increases employment.
I know that you guys on the left always love to talk about Europe as this model of employment law and how wonderful it is if we all were just had these very
Europeans seem to like it.
Socialized. So, well, some do, except for the ones who are unemployed. And the European unemployment rate is always much, much higher, particularly, I believe...
Well, that's because they honestly measure unemployment. We don't. Our actual, you know, according to the Republican Kevin Phillips, our actual unemployment rate is probably somewhere between 10 and 20%, depending on how you calculate it. And our underemployment rate pushes it clearly into the 20% range. The Europeans are honest about those numbers. We've been fudging them ever since Reagan.
Okay, well, if you remember not that long ago, there was incredible. There were riots in France over some of the problems facing employment. The young people's unemployment was so high that there were, you know, riots because people can't get jobs, and that's partially because these benefits are so generous. There's there's real problems caused by these socialized.
Actually,
benefits.
I would suggest to you that the riots were the result of the benefits being cut.
Well, why isn't Senator Obama then come out with it and just say, we need to have a whole year, the government is going to come out and just pay women a year for every time they have a kid, and those can just sit out of the labor force?
Well, I think if your goal was to have more children, that's probably a good idea. I'm not sure that that's a good goal.
But if it's so wonderful, why doesn't he come out and say that? I bet it's because he recognizes that it would really hurt the economy if he did so.
Okay. Carrie Lucas. Carrie, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks so much.
She's the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org, if you want to read her piece, Domestic Disturbance, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
What do they know? Go to simple man, baby, pays the thrills, the bills, the bills that care. All the that matter, you and me.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, particularly the sponsors you hear on our local radio stations. Let them know you're listening. Recommend their products. Patronize their products, if appropriate. If not, just, you know, thank them for advertising. And also brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at teamster.org. Speaking of the unfair trade deal with Colombia, by the way, just a heads up. John McCain is running Spanish language ads that are flying completely under the radar of the media, particularly down in Florida, asserting that trade with Colombia represents that Colombia is the third largest trading partner with the state of Florida. Not true. Suggesting that it's some $40 billion in trade or $50 billion in trade with Colombia. Not true. He's exaggerating all the numbers. He's talking about how wonderful, how the Colombians are going to love it, how it's going to help Florida. And in Spanish, it's full of lies. And nobody's calling him on it because it's in Spanish. So, anyhow, our conservative alert for the day. Yes, Mr. Sanford. Good old top VP candidate, McCain VP candidate, Mark Sanford, is asked. Now, here's a guy. They're thinking of having him as VP. He's out here as a surrogate for John McCain. And Wolf Blitzer asks him, you know, one of Wolf Blitzer's puffball, softball, easy, typical CNN questions.
Are there any significant economic differences between what the Bush administration has put forward over these many years as opposed to now what John McCain supports?
Yeah. I mean, for instance, take, for instance, the issue of I'm drawing a blank. I hate it when I do that, particularly on television. But take for instance, the contrast on NAFTA. I mean, I think that the bigger issue is credibility in where one is coming from.
No contrast.
On are they consistent where they come from? John McCain has consistently stood against earmarks throughout his tenure in the United States Senate.
So has Bush.
Regrettably, the president has not been exactly busy with the veto pen on earmarks. I mean, there's just one contrast alone. It's particularly...
Okay. Our conservative alert for the day. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. I love these conversations with Carrie and with folks who share her worldview because it really brings into sharp contrast these two competing visions of America. And the thing that we have to understand, the thing that you and I have to understand as people who get the vision that Franklin Roosevelt had, who get the vision of America as a we society, who understand that this has worked, and in fact works very well, thank you very much, in virtually all of the industrialized countries in the world, is that there are these two competing visions of what this country should become. And up until the 1980s, up until Reagan became president, virtually everybody agreed. When Dwight Eisenhower said there are a few Republicans, mostly oil men down in Texas, who believe that we should privatize Social Security and do away with unemployment insurance, he said they're crazy, and he called them idiots, as I recall, in his letter to his brother David. But while he was president, back in 57, I think it was, there was an absolute consensus right across America. Most Americans agreed that there is an appropriate role for government in the United States, in doing two things. And number one, catching people when they fall badly and helping them get back up on their feet so they can once again become productive members of society. Actually, three functions for government. Second, providing an infrastructure upon which we can build an economy, the soil in which small businesses in particular, which produce the most jobs in the United States, and medium and big-sized businesses as well, can grow. That infrastructure being public education, public transportation, good water, good reliable electricity, rural telephone system. I mean, just every the all that stuff that Franklin Roosevelt put into place. And number three, regulation of capitalism so that it doesn't destroy itself. Laissez-faire capitalism, as advocated by so-called free marketeers, will always lead to boom and bust cycles. Because you'll have these cycles where over time the big fish eat the small fish until there's no more small fish, there's only medium fish, and then the big fish start eating the medium fish and there's no more medium fish, and then every single mall that you walk into in America is just 25 stores and they're all the same 25 huge multinational corporations. And at that point, you got nothing but big fish. When you got nothing but big fish, the system starts crashing down. And so you go through these boom and bust cycles. And so the appropriate purpose of government is to, as Senator Sherman said in 1881, to prevent the emergence of these monopolies, of monopoly capitalism, to regulate capitalism. That's the liberal vision of America. And conservatives say, no, let them have their monopolies. It'll be fine.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at
866-303-2270. Money, but it wasn't enough to do the things that I most love. So my mama and my papa sold all their property, 'cause they knew how much it meant to me. I loaded up the pickup and I bid them farewell. I promised I would pay back every cent. All of the money will be well spent. I'm going to run for president.
34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, let's see. James Comey, who was the assistant attorney general when Ashcroft went into the hospital, you'll recall, was sitting in Ashcroft's hospital bed. This is a flashback to the past. This is his testimony before Chuck Schumer's committee. James Comey.
This day, March the 10th, 2004.
And how do you remember that date so well?
This was a very memorable period in my life, probably the most difficult time in my entire professional life. And that night was probably the most difficult night of my professional life. So it's not something I forget.
Okay. Were you present when Alberto Gonzalez visited Attorney General Ashcroft's bedside?
Yes.
And am I correct that the conduct of Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Card on that evening troubled you greatly?
Yes.
Okay. Let me go back and take it from the top.
Now, without revisiting the whole thing, basically Gonzalez and Card came in and they wanted Ashcroft to sign off on the illegal warrantless wiretap program that Bush was proposing. And the reason I bring you this from you know a year or so ago, this little clip of testimony, and it goes on and it gets more and more bizarre. I mean, this guy, you know, he was a high speed chase through the Capitol trying to get to the hospital bed before Gonzalez got there. Gonzalez came in, he wanted Ashcroft, who was nearly incoherent on morphine. He'd had a gallbladder surgery, he was in incredible pain. And Ashcroft lifts himself up and points at Comey and says, he's the attorney general. And Comey says, I won't sign it. And Gonzalez and Card, Andy Card and Alberto Gonzalez, these two criminals, leave the hospital bed of the attorney general of the United States, Ashcroft, and the acting attorney general, Comey, without the authorization of the Justice Department to do the illegal wiretaps on behalf of Bush. Very unhappy. Well, now it comes out. David Iglesias has just said, former New Mexico U.S. Attorney David Iglesias, he says, the only one intriguing question I've had was from a book buyer a few months ago who asked whether I thought John Ashcroft had been pushed out or not after he refused to sign off on the warrantless wiretaps. That's something that a journalist has never asked me. The honest answer is yes. That had Ashcroft done the wrong thing, the unconstitutional thing, and signed off on it, like Congress just did, I added that, not him, but anyhow, he probably still would be the attorney general. But Ashcroft served honorably. He did the right thing, and he paid the price. He was asked to move on. So we're now finding out, you know, just, you know, how far and how deep this criminal conspiracy in this administration goes. And it's pretty far and pretty deep. By the way, the Honorable Lamar Smith, Republican from Texas, he's on the House Judiciary Committee that's looking at the articles of impeachment that Dennis Kucinich is putting forward. He has said, I quote, "We should not underestimate the gravity of the case against the president. When he put his hand on the Bible and recited his oath of office, he swore to faithfully uphold the laws of the United States. Not some laws, all laws. The rules under which President Nixon would have been tried for impeachment had he not resigned contained this statement. The office of the president is such that it calls for a higher level of conduct than the average citizen of the United States," end quote. "This will not be an easy task. In fact, it is a difficult ordeal for all Americans, but we will get through it. We are a great nation and a strong people. Our country will endure because our Constitution works and has for 200 years. As much as we might wish to avoid this process of impeachment, we must resist the temptation to close our eyes and pass by. The president's actions must be evaluated for one simple truth. For some simple reason, the truth counts. No one is above the law. Actions have consequences. We, the people, should insist on these high ideals." So you might want to call Lamar Smith, the Republican from Texas, and say, hey, good on you for saying that about the Clinton impeachment. Why don't you say it now about the Bush impeachment? Or Sensenbrenner, the Republican from Wisconsin, he said, being a poor example isn't grounds for impeachment. Undermining the rule of law is. Impeachment is one of the checks the framers gave the Congress to prevent the executive or judicial branches from becoming corrupt or tyrannical. What is on trial here is the truth and the rule of law. So give James Sensenbrenner, the Republican from Wisconsin, a phone call. You can go to callcongress.org, and there's a toll-free number you can call and say, hey, Republican Congressman Sensenbrenner, good on you for saying that impeachment is about upholding the rule of law. You believed that during the Clinton administration? How about now? The same with the Honorable Howard Coble, the Republican from North Carolina, or the Honorable Elton Gallagly of California. He says, a society without laws is anarchy. Societies that ignore the laws are condemned to violence and chaos. I believe in the rule of law. This president violated the Constitution. To condone this would be to condemn our society to anarchy. Mr. Chairman, I cannot and will not condone such action. Speaking in favor of impeachment. The Republican. That was the Republican Gallagly from California. Or Bob Goodlett, the Republican from Virginia. These guys are all still on the Judiciary Committee. He says, implicit in that idea is the principle that no one is above the law, including the chief executive. If we truly respect the presidency, we cannot allow the president to be above the law. When a factory worker, a medical doctor, a retiree breaks the law, they do so with the knowledge that they are not above the law. This same principle must also apply to the most powerful and privileged in our nation, including the president of the United States. To lose this principle devastates a legacy entrusted to us by our founding fathers and protected to us by generations of American families. I'm quoting from the Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, the Honorable Bob Goodlatt. I think it's Goodlatt. Maybe it's Goodlatte. I don't know. G-O-O-D-L-A-T-T-E. I have a constitutional duty, the Republican from Virginia said, to follow the truth wherever it leads. The truth in this case leads me to believe that the president knowingly engaged in a calculated pattern of lies, deceit, and delay in order to mislead the American people. Therefore, he votes for impeachment. The Honorable Stevens Chabot, C-H-A-B-O-T, from Ohio, the Republican. He says, it has become apparent to me that impeachment is the only remedy that adequately addresses this president's illegal and unethical acts. When we cast our votes, we are not voting as Republicans or Democrats. We are voting as Americans. Our allegiance does not lie with any one president, but with our country. Our charge is not handed down from any one political party, but from the Constitution. So you might want to call Steve Chabot of Ohio, the Republican, and say, you know, those words you spoke during the Clinton impeachment, they were so true. Why don't you read them again? Or the Honorable Chris Cannon, the Republican from Utah. He said, we are at a defining moment in our history. What we do here will set the standard for what is acceptable for this and future presidents. I believe profoundly that the behavior of this president is unacceptable because I agree with John Jay, one of our founding fathers, who said when oaths cease to be sacred, our dearest and most valuable rights become unsecure. insecure. I submit that in the spirit of our founding fathers and John F. Kennedy, that our first duty is to provide for the security, the fundamental rights of Americans to properly perform that duty. We must vote to impeach the president. Thank you. The Republican, the Honorable Chris Cannon, might want to call him and thank him for saying that about impeaching Bill Clinton, and ask why it doesn't apply even more so to George W. Bush. John in North Hollywood, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. A while back you mentioned that we've been having a war of ideas in this country.
Yes.
And the one thing I'd like to mention is that that we've been having wars of ideas ever since and people have been able to come up with ideas, whether it's Marie Antoinette or Madame LaFarge. So I don't quite say that is what made the last 50 years different. But one of the things that I think has made the last 50 years different in this war of ideas is that the market for ideas, okay, the media, which controls the market, it seems, for ideas, has become monopolized and centralized, and therefore makes it more of a war on ideas that don't fit the ideas that wish to be disseminated by the major holders of the media.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And
John,
and it's not just corporations, but it's the whole mindset of commercial material motivations, okay? The motivation to dominate of an industry is existent in a small business as well as in a corporation, because of the misconception in our society that competition means ability to lord it over the next guy.
Right. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. So when the
media marketplace for ideas is dominated,
and this is why you don't see
change.
This is why you don't see Amy Goodman on Hardball. This is why you see three conservatives to one liberal. This is why you don't see real progressives on national television, rarely, and when they are absolutely outnumbered and overwhelmed.
But not just that, sir. You don't see much media such as Pacifica that is listener sponsored. It's all either corporate or commercially sponsored.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons. Exactly, it's one of the reasons. No, you're spot on, John. It's one of the reasons why they have been working so hard to roll back government funding of NPR so that they can bring in corporate sponsorships. And what's happened over the last 20 years or so with these corporate sponsorships is that the nature of the programming on NPR, now they have business shows every day. What happened to the labor shows? What happened to the people?
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our telephone number. Andy in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Andy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to make a comment about family and medical leave.
Yeah, the FMLA that Kerry was opposed to.
Yeah, since it's come around, I've used it. I've known a lot of people that have saved their jobs. It saved my job. And the conservative viewpoint that somehow this is going to harm business and it's going to make business impossible to operate is it's not valid, because the people in the 1990s, we had a huge business boom around here, and FMLA was one of the few things that workers got on their side. out of all that, and business had huge expansion. We had record profits. I mean, it was a good time to be involved in the stock market, so FMLA really didn't affect that. So the Obama proposals are pretty modest, but they are sorely needed in order for workers to have more protection than they already do.
Yeah, amen. Thank you, Andy. Yeah, in fact, Obama's proposal with regard to FMLA is instead of people getting 7 unpaid sick days a year, that they get 7 paid sick days a year. They'd be required by law, employers be required by law to offer 7 paid sick days a year, and that it not just apply to companies with over 50 employees, but it apply to companies with over 25 employees. And it just seems reasonable to me. Amy in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I also want to talk about the family and medical leave. Your guest was being kind of selective about her cough because when people are forced to choose between a sick relative and a job, what really ends up happening is that the business costs go up in terms of turnover and absenteeism, having to retrain people.
You're right.
Yeah, and so it's really a good business decision. And she was concerned about people losing their jobs, but obviously the people who don't have a choice, they have to take care of their sick family member, they're going to lose their jobs. So, you know, why isn't she concerned about them losing their jobs?
Well, you'd have to ask her that, and
right.
You can do that over at her website. But, a very articulate spokesman for my position. I appreciate that. Thank you, Amy. Well said. Jackie in Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie.
Hi. I'm about halfway through The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein.
It's a brilliant book. She's going to be a guest on the show tomorrow, by the way.
Well, I believe it's a book that everyone should read and actually should be a history and or economic textbook in schools.
Yes, I agree.
Well, after reading that, I feel like our country is very vulnerable right now with the current instability in the economic situation.
Yeah, they're setting up the next shock.
Yeah, because people are fearful and in some cases desperate. And historically, according to this book, and it is so true, that this is the exact scenario where proponents of the Chicago School of Economics and laissez-faire theory, they swoop in and they change laws while people are mentally numb and scared.
Yeah, and they did it in Chile, and they did it in Russia, and they did it with disastrous results in both cases. They did it in Iraq with disastrous results, and they continue to promote it. And now they want to do it in the United States. Absolutely, Jack. Very well, Jackie. Very well said. And thank you very much for the call. Jamie in San Diego. Hey, Jamie. No, Jamie. Eric in Beaver, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric.
Hi, Tom. Great show, by the way. I've always wondered why, if we're tax and spend Democrats, why this current administration isn't borrow and blow Republicans.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what they're doing. They're borrowing the money and they're blowing it on everything in sight, or they're blowing up buildings. I guess there's probably even other meanings that you could attach to that. Line three, I'm sorry, the software has dropped your name and city, but you're calling about Buckley versus Viejo?
Yeah, I'm Gene from Los Angeles.
Thanks, Gene.
Tom, the Supreme Court, Congress in 1974, when they made the law that implemented campaign spending limits in their own election races. You remember that, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, okay, so here we have Congress making campaign spending limits, and the only reason why they didn't implement them is because the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional.
Right, in Buckley versus Viejo.
Well, so now
Vallejo.
We have campaigns that are spending 50 times or about 50 times as much as that campaign spending limit that Congress implemented.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the reasons why it's so important that we pay attention to the composition of the Supreme Court. Because the Supreme Court basically said, oh, yeah, the First Amendment, that means you can spend anything. And you can have it a completely corrupt political process. And prior to that, the courts had agreed that having a non-corrupt political process was actually a higher value than so-called free speech, that there are limits on free speech. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. There are certain things you can't say in certain circumstances and in the realm of politics as well. Ain't a good thing. Just ain't a good thing. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, got about a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Okay, very quickly. It's about the bankruptcy bill.
Yeah. And it's responsible for so much distress in the middle class.
I agree.
And yet liberals like John Edwards and Joe Biden voted for it. I don't understand that.
John Edwards, to the best of my knowledge, has apologized for that vote. Joe Biden comes from a state whose one of its major industries is credit card companies. So I guess, you know, I don't know that he's ever been held to account for it. My member of Congress, my congresswoman, voted for it, which horrified me. I let her know that. In fact, I had her on the air and took her to task for it, and she just said, "Oh, it's about individual responsibility." I said, "No, it's not. It's about protecting the butts of the credit card companies because they're about to tighten the rules and they don't want people to be able to weasel out or wiggle out, rather."
Now, has Senator Obama discussed revising it?
You know, I honestly don't know, and I would hope that he does, because reforming the bankruptcy reform, because it really wasn't a reform. What it was is, instead of calling it the Bankruptcy Reform Act or whatever they called it, they should call it the Screw Middle Class America Act, which is what it was and what it did. Anyhow, 58 minutes past the hour. Coming up, Gene Healy, Vice President and Senior Editor at the Cato Institute. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
This is Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. How much power should a president have? What does the Constitution specify, and how have we, shall we say, strayed from that? How have presidents strayed from it throughout history? How did John Adams, for example, stray from it? Gene Healy is with us. He's Vice President and Senior Editor at the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank. It reviews and edits Cato Policy Studies and other publications. He has a new book out called The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. Gene, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Your book is, I would say, relatively nonpartisan in how harshly it treats our various presidents, you know, going after everybody, you know, Nixon and Roosevelt in virtually the same breath for promoting an imperial presidency. You suggest that Bush is simply the reincarnation of Harry Truman in some regards. Give us the frame for this.
Well, I don't think that too often these days, particularly in Washington, the Constitution is a red team, blue team issue, and the party that's in power had previously been criticizing abuses of executive power suddenly finds out that vast unchecked unilateral powers are not such a bad thing when you have them. And so what I tried to do in the book is really get away from that to talk about how far we've drifted from the framers' original notion of what the presidency was supposed to be, which was an important job, but a limited job, a constitutional officer whose main task was faithful execution of the laws. And I think a lot of our problems with American government today come from a result of how far we've strayed from that vision.
You know, there's one of the kind of conventional wisdom thoughts about the major change in American politics of the relationship of, for example, states to federal government, and I would say the executive branch to all others, is that it happened after the Civil War, that prior to the Civil War we had strong states and a weak federal government, and that with the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War, and the Civil War itself, and all the executive orders and rules that President Lincoln was able to put into effect, that the presidency became more powerful and that the states became weaker and the federal government became stronger. Where did this concept of executive orders, of the president being able to actually essentially make laws rather than simply issue an order that was, this is my way of instituting the policy or the law that Congress made, where did that originate?
Well, you see a lot of it. The three presidents who issued the most executive orders in the 20th century were the three giants of the early 20th century, T.R., Woodrow Wilson, and FDR. Mm-hmm. And you really start seeing it with TR. I mean, of course, there are executive orders from for Teddy Roosevelt. You know, there are executive orders from early on, but as particularly in the early part of the 20th century, they begin to shift.
Wouldn't you say Abraham Lincoln issued as many executive orders as?
Well,
actually, I'd say probably far more.
No, I mean, at least in terms of the political scientists who keep the record. And then there's a little room for play in the definitions, but the numbers I've seen.
Well, you could argue he was fighting a war.
Teddy Roosevelt issued many more executive orders than any of his predecessors.
But arguably, I mean, you look at Teddy Roosevelt's executive orders, and most of them had to do with, you know, for example, you had the 1881 Sherman Antitrust Act. And you know, one of the major things that Roosevelt is remembered for is vigorously enforcing that. So he would issue executive orders directing his various cabinet offices, his departments, to fulfill the law. In other words, he was basically saying, but was he creating law? I mean, it seems to me that in particularly since Nixon, I mean, things like, you know, the continuity of government and stuff like that emergency powers, that we have executive orders now that are literally creating law out of nothing.
Well, you're right. There is a shift, you know, particularly as the 20th century goes on, there's a shift towards more policy-based executive orders to where in some cases the president is really just making law out of whole cloth. By arguing that he's just interpreting existing law. I mean, for example, the faith-based programs, the faith-based initiatives.
Right, which came out of the Clinton administration.
Entirely executive order. You know, executive orders are a problem. But I mean, there are other, significant problems, with the powers of the presidency, abrogation of Congress's power to declare war. Is an enormous problem. The warrantless wiretapping scheme put into effect after 9/11 in secret and entirely by executive fiat until recently. This is a problem. And one of the points of the book is that, you know, if we're concerned about these things, we have to recognize that it's not just bad luck that Americans have gotten a series of presidents that want to expand their power. In some ways, people do get the government they deserve, and one of the reasons for the growth of executive power is all of the vast expectations that we place into this job.
Just thinking that couldn't you argue that because most countries separate the functions of head of state and head of government, in Israel you have a president and a prime minister, and the president performs the ceremonial functions, the prime minister runs the government. In the United Kingdom you have a queen and a prime minister, and the queen cuts the ribbons and represents the country, and the prime minister runs the government. And so the people are not so much in their prime ministers, in their who's going to run the government, who's going to execute the will of parliament. They're not so much looking for the flashy guy. You know, Gordon Brown is not very much not the flashy guy. I mean, he's got one glass eye. You know, he's a brilliant Rhodes Scholar, not a Rhodes Scholar, but, you know, graduate of Oxford, brilliant scholar. But he's Mr. You know, rumpled suit, you know.
That's a great point. There's I quote somebody.
We integrate them in this country.
Right. No. It's a great point. I quote somebody later in the book talking about the very point about the combining the head of state, head of government, all these functions, and also about how the British, no one thinks that Gordon Brown is responsible for the state of the British national soul. It's just not the prime minister's job, and
that's
it's,
right.
it's a more businesslike and unromantic view of the function.
Right, and this is why a number of European countries, I mean the Dutch, the Danish, the Swedes, you know, are maintaining their royalty, even though they've stripped it of all power, because they, and the Japanese for that matter, because they want to maintain that head of state institution that is the figurehead, as it were, and Reagan really captured that. I mean, Reagan and John Kennedy did, I would say. Both of them fulfilled the role of head of state and head of government at the same time in a way that probably served to amplify executive power. What's the solution then?
Well, that's probably the $64,000 question. In the end of the book, I lay out a couple of legislative solutions to various problems that I've identified. You know, ways to strengthen the war powers resolution, for example. But you know, when you look at them, the experience of writing the whole book, you know, this is not a problem that is going to be solved with a 5-point plan. One of the reasons that things like war powers reform, the war powers resolution, one of the reasons that sort of thing doesn't work out is because, you know, these mega statutes that Congress passes attempting to bind its own hands in the future, Congress almost always has a way out of that. And sure, I do think it may not be a perfectly satisfying answer in the sense that, you know, here are the five things that you're supposed to do. But I do think it comes down to changing how we look at this office. I think part of it comes down to getting away from the red team, blue team mentality and the false idol of partisanship, and also to stop expecting the president to be the person that is going to save us from hurricanes, teach our children well, answer the phone at 3 a.m. to keep your kids safe from harm.
Right.
We need to think of this more in
an administrative function.
Function.
Yeah,
so there are any number of things we could do to get from here to there, but I think ultimately we have to change how we look at the office.
Fascinating. Gene Healy of the Cato Institute, The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. Thought-provoking book. Gene, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Coming up next, though, Steve Greenhouse, labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times, about the big squeeze.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
What Barbara Ehrenreich had to say about Steve Greenhouse's new book, The Big Squeeze. Stephen Greenhouse's brilliant and vividly reported expose shows how employers have been squeezing the life out of American workers through means both legal and illegal. My blood boiled when I read The Big Squeeze. Any presidential candidate or voter who overlooks this book will be clueless about what's really going on in America. Our weekly labor segment, Stephen Greenhouse is with us, the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. His new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, his website, StephenGreenhouse.com. Stephen, welcome.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, what is The Big Squeeze?
The Big Squeeze is a squeeze on workers in many ways. Things are tougher for the nation's workers, young and old workers, blue-collar and white-collar workers, black, white, Hispanic workers, than was the case a decade and two decades ago. Wages have been flat, health and pension benefits are getting worse, and we're all being pushed to work harder as well.
Right. I see, you know, I've got columns by you from July 3rd and July 11th in the New York Times, and you're the labor writer for the New York Times. I'm old enough to remember growing up in Michigan where we had the two statewide newspapers, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. One was the labor paper. The other was the business paper. One had literally a labor section and no business section and reliably supported the Democratic candidates. The other had a business section and no labor section, reliably supported the Republican candidates. And it was that way pretty much all over the country. The New York Times used to have a labor section. Why is there no longer a labor section in the New York Times, the newspaper for which you write, and why are there no longer labor sections in any newspapers in the United States that I know of?
Well, you know, partly, Tom, you know, the labor movement, labor unions are not as powerful as they used to be. They used to represent more than 1 in 3 workers. Now they represent 1 in 8, and in the private sector, just 1 in, you know, less than 1 in 12. I think that's part of it. You know, the New York Times used to have 4 people who covered unions full time. Now there's me, and I cover unions plus, you know, workplace matters like discrimination cases. But we have a pension reporter now, and we have a reporter who covers health, you know, health coverage. So people cover different parts.
Right, but how many people do you have covering business?
Well, we have a lot of people covering business, you know, and
partly huge.
There's a lot of people out there who like to follow how money is invested. I think part of the reasons, Tom, that I wrote this book is that there isn't enough coverage of what's happening to workers. And then my book really tries to write about, you know, how globalization is hurting workers, how using more and more temps is hurting workers, how the squeeze on wages is hurting workers and making many.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to condemn your employer here, Stephen.
I'm not. I think my employer does a better job than any other paper in the country in terms of covering workplace matters. I would not condemn them.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then that's a real indictment of every other newspaper in the country. You know, I would submit, and that's, you know, one of the problems is that there's virtually no discussion of labor. You can turn on the TV every night. NPR has, you know, their business report every day. At least we do here. I think it comes from one of the other networks along with NPR. But I mean, it's like there is no discussion. Now, your book, the Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. We're talking with Stephen Greenhouse, the labor reporter and workplace reporter for the New York Times. StephenGreenhouse.com is website. Your book is, and you know, Barbara Ehrenreich and, you know, Nickel and Dimes and other books. You know, there's a few people who are writing on these topics, David Sirota, but my book, Screwed. But by and large, it's not the sexy stuff. It's not the Tom Peters, you know, huge New York Times bestseller, here's how we're going to reinvent business, who moved my cheese kind of stuff. How do we, in the United States, get back to the idea, you know, Lincoln said, you know, labor is superior to capital because it precedes capital. In other words, you don't have money until somebody does something, somebody makes something. How do we get back in the United States to this notion of honoring labor at least as much as we honor capital?
That's a very good question, Tom. You know, I suggest in the book, The Big Squeeze, that we need, as a nation, the news media, politicians, church leaders have to pay more attention to workers. Workers are too often, you know, forgotten. You know, all the attention is to the Paris Hiltons and the Madonnas and the A-Rods and the Bill Gates, and not enough attention or respect is paid, you know, to the Willie Loman, so to speak, to the, you know, to the Americans who get the job done. And one, again, you know, one reason I wrote this book is to show that American workers are under a huge squeeze. They're often mistreated, and I try to bring to the nation's attention, as you did in your book, Screwed, Tom, to show that, you know, things are pretty bad, and we as a nation should really see what's happening, learn what's happening, and then, you know, figure out what we're going to do about it.
Yeah, step by step. And so much of this really began, I mean, obviously Taft-Hartley in 47, but, you know, the real war on organized labor in the middle class, I would say, was declared by Ronald Reagan when he busted PATCO.
Well, yes, I mean, in the 1980s, there was really a sea change for the nation's workers, and part of it was there was more import competition than ever before. Partly, you know, the federal government became in many ways anti-union, you know, with Reagan breaking the PATCO strike, and partly Wall Street really started to squeeze, you know, companies and CEOs more than ever before in the 1980s.
Right, the pump and dump shops like Mitt Romney's Bain Capital, Bain Financial, those kind of things. So so we have this incredible confluence. A great job of documenting it. Stephen Greenhouse, the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. His new book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. The website, Stephen Greenhouse, spelled just like it sounds, S-T-E-V-E-N, greenhouse.com. Stephen, thank you for being with us.
Nice to be here, Tom. Sir, I couldn't be here longer. Lots to discuss.
Good talking with you. 26 Thanks. Minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Just a reminder to our listeners in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at WTKG, on Friday of this week, on July 18th, I'll be doing my show from from WTKG. But that evening, from 6:30 to 7:30, we'll have a book signing and dinner buffet courtesy of Lanning's Catering at the UAW Regional Offices. That's at East Beltline Avenue Northeast at Leonard Street Northeast in Grand Rapids, 3300 Leonard Northeast. And all that information is over at our website, tomhartman.com. Just click on the calendar and you can get right to it if you'd like to show up and say hi in Grand Rapids Friday night. I'm looking forward to it. Well, strange things going on in the world, I'm telling you. It's downright crazy out there.
Baby, I'm crazy.
So first of all, the Presidential Memorial Commission of San Francisco went out and got signature petitions to rename the sewage facility, the sewage treatment plant in San Francisco, the George Bush sewage plant, George W. Bush sewage plant, instead of the current name, the Oceanside Water Pollution Control Plant. And you know, they went out and gathered petitions, and one of the guys, the commission's founder, Brian McConnell, this is in an interview with the British Broadcasting Corporation, he's talking about how, well, you know, a lot of people liked the idea. They signed the petitions. They thought it was funny. They thought it was a joke, or they thought it was kind of cool naming it after the president. But there were also some people who weren't so keen on the idea.
You know, other people, you know, the two thumbs up as they walked up. What was interesting was the opposition. We knew there'd be opposition, but what we weren't expecting is that most of the opposition was coming from people that didn't want to name anything. They just wanted to forget about the past 8 years and move on. Or they felt that, you know, this is a facility that does something really quite useful, and it would be inappropriate, you know, to put his name on it.
What did you think of that?
We were kind of surprised by that, you know, because, you know, if you get to the point where people are defending the sewage plant, that's a sign that, things have not gone so well.
Yeah, that's a sign that things have not gone so well. Good on you, Brian McConnell. Of course, an interview that would only happen on the CBC or BBC, one or the other, as opposed to, CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. You're not going to hear that in the United States. Well, I guess you just heard it here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jim in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm just wondering if you happen to see the story on Raw Story about the gentleman at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, by the name of Roger Shuler, who was fired, he claims, for doing blogging about the fact that Don Siegelman was politically prosecuted by two of the U.S. attorneys in Alabama.
Yeah, and not only did I see it, but he's going to be a guest on our show tomorrow.
Ah, terrific.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to make sure you were. It's not.
I am. And a tip of the hat to Larissa Alexandrovna, who
actually
sent
it was
me
not
a note
her.
Yeah, but she sent me a note pointing it out.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Thank you, Larissa.
You've got more connections than I do, too.
Yeah, I get, you know, it's amazing the amount of stuff I get, but if it comes from a Larissa, I definitely pay attention to it. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It is a good story, and you'll hear all about it tomorrow here. On the program. Let's see here. Alan, Eugene. Hey, Al, what's up?
I'm having a hard time dealing with this welfare program that they've just instituted where they're going to give money to Fannie Mae and her boyfriend.
Yeah, Freddie Mac.
Freddie. But there's no conditions to it.
Right. Well, the reason why is because if Freddie and Fannie fail, then the entire American system is going to go down. That's the short-term disaster scenario.
Right. I understand.
The bigger problem, though, that most people don't realize, Al, is we're talking about $5 trillion in mortgages. We're talking about half the entire U.S. mortgage market, basically. And if we decide to simply bail them out, if the Fed bails them out by opening their discount window, which is the phrase, I believe, that was used yesterday by Paulson, mm-hmm. if that's how it's done, then then that means that we are basically printing $5 trillion, and that is going to lead to monstrous inflation a year, 2 years down the road. And if Barack Obama becomes president, you're going to see inflation kicking out, or for that matter, John McCain. If this is how it's done, if they do this by printing money, then what you're going to see is inflation spiking to 10%, 20%, 30%. I mean, we have real inflation right now in this country of at least 10, 15%, and it's going to probably double that, and it's going to be an absolute screaming disaster. And but on the other hand, you know, see, this is they shouldn't have privatized Freddie and Fannie in the first place.
Right.
And no, and they shouldn't have done away with mortgage lending standards in the first place. I mean, this is what you're seeing here is the failure of Greenspan, Rubin, and Summers, the three golden haired boys who were on the cover of Time magazine in July of 1999 as the ones who brought you all this wonderful stuff with this economy until people realized it was a bubble economy, and then the dot-com bubble got replaced by the mortgage bubble, thanks to Greenspan.
I don't disagree with you at all. That was not my point, however.
Okay,
my point is that we're still going to have these big executives taking home tens of billions,
yep.
Tens of millions of dollars.
Yep.
There's not going to be any limits to the, you know, it's all going to be profits to these corporations.
Yep.
And yet
the rich get rich and everybody else gets screwed. I mean, that's how the system is set up, and that's, and you know, it's the Republican way, and I would say that to some extent, that's the Democratic way as well, in as much as the Democratic Party has been complicit in this kind of stuff happening. There's been this consensus since the 80s that the Cato Foundation, Cato Institute, and the Heritage Foundation, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and all these think tanks that supply all these talking heads that you can see on television every single night have for 30 years been promoting this idea that the only way a society should be organized is for the at the level of individual greed, and that has produced this disaster, Al. I thank you for calling, and you're absolutely right. It is socialism for the rich, and a so-called free market economy for all the rest of us. And there's going to be a lot of people hurt, and it's going to be mostly pensioners and whatnot, because we are going to see massive inflation as a consequence of the combination of $1 trillion on this war and then, you know, a couple $1 trillion to bail out Fannie and Freddie. I mean, it's going to be a disaster. Alan in Miami, Florida, you want to disagree with me?
Not exactly disagree, just a premise that was expressed a few minutes ago about labor preceding capital.
That was, I was quoting Lincoln.
Yeah, I generally agree with everything you say, Tom, and I admire your passion and your energy. But it seems to me that without capital to create a venue for labor to take place and to provide materials for something to be produced, labor doesn't function without capital behind it to set up the mechanisms for producing something.
Well, okay, let me give you a case in point that disputes that.
Okay, sure.
Microsoft.
Uh-huh.
How much capital started Microsoft?
Nothing. It was in a garage.
That's right. Apple. How much capital started Apple?
None.
Okay. How much capital started Ford Motor Company?
I have no idea.
It was virtually nothing. Henry Ford had declared bankruptcy 7 times. He had nothing.
Uh-huh.
The bottom line is that most companies in the United States started out as small businesses. In fact, I'd say probably virtually all companies of any consequence that weren't spun off from large businesses. And they started out with labor. They started out with what's called sweat equity. Entrepreneur knows what sweat equity is. And that's
right.
Labor as capital. I mean, every business that I've started, and I've started 5 that have gone on to become, you know, multi-million dollar businesses, out of the 7 that we've started, every single one of them, the first year or 2 or 3, I worked with no paycheck whatsoever.
Right.
And that's what most entrepreneurs do. And then, you know, on the backside, you sell the business or whatever, you know, and you take your money back out on the backside. But you put in that sweat equity. And so I would submit to you that labor is superior to capital. And even in a capitalist system, typically labor is superior to capital because it precedes it.
The idea of a discount window is really intriguing. And the image of Edward Hopper lighting of a beady-eyed little guy with a green eye shade and sleeve garters sitting in that window, doling out is an amazing picture.
Yeah, the whole discount window metaphor that they're using for the Fed, Alan, thank you for the call. I agree with you. It's a very useful frame for them to keep us from realizing that what's really going on is they're going to be, I think you call it, is the printing press window. you know, because they're going to be, you know, just basically passing out all this money to people, and not a good thing. George in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, George.
Hi, Tom. Really appreciate your show.
Thank you.
And I'm going to be quick here. I was drawing something here, trying to understand how all this situation came about, and I see it. I pictured a circle of power where you have the Fed, the CFR, the banks, Congress, mainstream media, K Street, the executive branch, the Supreme Court, and the workers are left out, obviously.
Yeah, it's the man, it's the machine. You're right.
Can you help me understand Nancy Pelosi?
No, I can't. I am baffled by Nancy Pelosi, frankly. There are times when I think that Nancy Pelosi is just absolutely extraordinary, and there are times when I shake my head in disbelief.
Exactly.
She's obviously a political animal. I mean, you know, she politics is driving a lot of what she's doing. Apparently she's, you know, the Democrats are keeping her in leadership. There must be a consensus among the Democrats that she's doing a good job. I'm not going to second guess that. I'm not a Democrat in Congress, but this thing of taking impeachment off the table, for example, I think that's one of the biggest things that has everybody. And then, you know, pushing through the whole FISA retake, after it had been shot down by the Senate the last time. And on the other hand, you know, her first 100 days and all the, her legislative agenda, she did some marvelous things. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
One big union, 9.5 minutes before the hour, and I'm telling you, it's getting totally strange. They keep getting it wrong. Fred Phelps and his Westboro Baptist Church. These guys, when I lived in Vermont, we lived in Montpelier, Vermont, and it was the year we were living, you know, just five blocks from downtown, and it was the year that Howard Dean signed into law the civil unions bill. Because the Vermont Supreme Court looked back at the Constitution that Vermont had, one of the oldest, actually preceded the U.S. Constitution, it was afterwards, but Vermont was an independent nation before the United States was created, before they became a state, after the U.S. was created, before they became a state. And they would look back at our Constitution, and they said, hey, this gives rights to gays to get married. It doesn't say men and women. You can't discriminate. And so, the legislature passed civil unions, Howard Dean signed it, and for weeks, these people were out in front of the Capitol building. I walked by them every day, or almost every day, and with these signs that said, God hates fags. And now they're going to be out in front of Tony Snow's funeral. Fred Phelps and his right-wing buddies at the Westboro Baptist Church, they're going to picket Tony Snow's funeral because he was, quote, a high-profile representative of godless big media and big government. And because the reason why they've been picketing these war, you know, the funerals of our soldiers from Iraq, he says, they say war casualties are divine revenge for America tolerating gays and lesbians. This is their entire agenda, is that God hates their signs. They carry around these signs that says God hates fags. And you got to say, you guys keep getting it wrong. God doesn't hate fags. God hates figs. It's a typo. And in fact, you can find, look at Matthew 21. Jesus rebukes the fig as an evil abomination. Okay, he comes back, he's hungry, he sees a fig tree by the road, found nothing on it but leaves only. He said to it, Let no fruit grow on you henceforth forever. And presently the fig tree withered away. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how soon is the fig tree withered away? See, Jesus curses a fig tree. Here's another one, Mark 11, 12 through 14. The next day when they came from Bethany, he was hungry, seeing a fig tree far off. He came, and perhaps he might find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. And Jesus said, no man eat fruit of you hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. See, God hates figs. In Psalms, the Old Testament, 78:47, he destroyed their vines with hail, and he destroyed their sycamore figs with sleet. Don't you get it? God hates figs. God also, it promises terrible vengeance for fig eaters. Jeremiah 29:17. Yes, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I will send the sword, famine, and plague against them, and I will make them like poor figs that are so bad they cannot be eaten. You got somebody needs to tell the folks over at the Westboro Baptist Church to get over to the website, GodHatesFigs.com, and get it right. And then they can start picketing the fig companies out in California. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Leon in Seattle. Hey, Leon, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was just calling. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I hear folks talk about how well everyone's doing, Republicans. I hear on Bill Moyers the other night. And this whole idea somehow, we need to have a discussion as what is real wealth?
Yeah.
What makes people wealthy or comfortable? What is poverty in this country?
Yeah, you know, we really haven't had that conversation since the 60s when Lyndon Johnson declared the war on poverty. And really, Bobby Kennedy was the guy who started that discussion.
Yeah, and, you know, because the Republican kind of approach is because the poor have more gadgets or, you know, are overweight, then they're no longer poor.
Right. This is Phil Graham said, we're the only nation in the world with fat poor people.
Yeah.
As if that was a sign of what? An excess of food?
Yeah.
You know.
A long term. What makes is it you know access to good education, you know, a clean environment, good schools. You know.
Well, and it goes beyond that. And this is one of the subtle distinctions that a lot of people miss, Leon, and that is that there's a difference between wealth and income. They will say, for example, you know, among the black middle class, you know, income levels in many cases in many towns are not that different from the white middle class. But the wealth of the black middle class
exactly.
is considerably lower than the wealth of the white middle class.
Net worth.
Because the white middle class has had generations to have homes to pass from fathers to children, and fathers, you know, from family to family. And there's also a cultural wealth there as well.
Yeah, and our collective wealth. I think so many times we're constantly told we're consumers and not citizens. And the collective wealth we have in this country is citizens.
Right, and the collective wealth of the commons is also disparate in as much as in very high-income neighborhoods, very wealthy neighborhoods, you tend to have very wealthy schools, very high-quality schools. In very poor neighborhoods, you have poor schools, just as one example. And you know, I mean, the cons love to trash the Washington, D.C. schools and say, see, this is proof that throwing money at schools and teachers doesn't make any difference because, you know, they put a lot of money into those schools. But the fact of the matter is that you've got a school system as the dam that's trying to hold back this massive Mississippi River that's poverty.
Right.
And a school system by itself can't be the only thing that fights poverty. You know, the best thing to fight poverty is a job.
Right.
And there's no industrial infrastructure in Washington, D.C., and there's not much of a job base there. And you've got a large black population because in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it was a city under federal protection. And particularly after World War II, it was one of the few places where blacks could go and know that legally they wouldn't get killed. Anyhow, we've wandered far afield. Tomorrow, Dan Gaynor, Vice President of Business and Media Institute, he's going to tell us why the gloom and doom about the economy, all manufactured by the media. That should be interesting. And Naomi Klein is going to drop by, talk about her thoughts on FISA, her new book, The Shock Doctrine. Plus, we're going to hear from a blogger who got fired for talking about Don Siegelman down in Alabama. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.